Hi, everyone. This is Dr. Cheryl Selman, and welcome to What Women Must Know. This is a show that really has as its purpose the focus to empower you with truthful information so you can make the most informed decision possible regarding your health and well-being. And I am just so pleased you're joining me again for another wonderful, empowering, life-changing conversation. If you are listening for the very first time, please go over to my Facebook page, which is What Women Must Know. Like me there, because I post all of my interviews, so you can catch the interviews I do on What Women Must Know. And also, I have a second show on Progressive Radio Network called The Love Code every Saturday at 11 a.m., and that show is also posted there. And if you'd like to visit me on my website, which is Dr. Cheryl Selman, you're most welcome to do that. You can opt in there. I will send the archive shows to you along with other information and research and whatever else I've got going on, so you can stay connected to the community of empowered women and men. By the way, the show is certainly for men as well as women, because all of the issues are just so profound and really helps us to navigate through our life. And today we have another really profound conversation, because we're going to be talking with Dr. Timothy Smith about reversing Alzheimer's, and that's the name of his new book. And let me just share a little bit about Dr. Smith. He's been studying and practicing alternative, functional, nutritional, and conventional healing principles for almost 50 years. He graduated from the University of Cincinnati College of Medicine, completing his residency in psychiatry, specializing in brain biochemistry at the University of California, San Francisco, and San Francisco General Hospital. He then trained to become a doctor of traditional Chinese medicine in San Francisco, Japan, and China, and he taught TCM to thousands of physicians at the University of California, Los Angeles. He published his bestseller, Renewal, The Anti-Aging Revolution, in the year 2000, and Dr. Smith's recent focus has been on the latest research developments in molecular, functional, and nutritional medicine and epigenetics applied to the prevention and treatment of Alzheimer's disease. And his new book that is just released is called Reversing Alzheimer's. And it's such a pleasure to welcome Dr. Timothy Smith to the show. So hello and welcome, Tim.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, you have such an interesting background. And, before we got on air, I was just having a chat with you and commenting on how impressed I was with your open, curious mind, exploring so many healing modalities and, integrating all this knowledge and wisdom into the journey that you're on right now. So I just want to thank you for that commitment you've had to be open and to search and to learn.
Well, thank you. What can I say? I think I'm just interested in so many different things, and I've been fortunate to have a career in which I can range far and wide in subject matter and have it come together for me. So thank you.
You're so welcome. And it's not always easy as you explore all these different modalities to then be able to unify them in the unified field of healing. But they are all connected in some very profound ways that allow us to get some real solutions and understanding of these various challenges that we're facing. And particularly now we're talking about Alzheimer's, but I have to say, when you wrote your book 20 years ago, Renewal, which I didn't know about then, but I mean, that was pretty groundbreaking, because 20 years ago, I don't think a lot of people were really talking about anti-aging at that point in time. I wasn't, that's for sure.
it was like a wave that was about to break when my book was written, right at the end of 1999, actually. And there were articles about it, but really very few books. I don't remember, there may not have been any, but But it was definitely an idea whose time had come, and it emerged directly out of the advances that we had been making in integrative medicine. The ideas of how, and also cell biology, I have to say, and understanding of how aging happened and why cells and bodies and living things go through a life cycle, how it works inside, really wasn't understood. And the depth of understanding of it came to a point right then when anti-aging came along. Actually, Dirk Pearson and Sandy Shaw's book, Life Extension, had come out before my book. And I read that, and I didn't like a lot of the things they were saying. And so I said, I'll write my own book.
Nothing like having a mission.
I think my mission back then was more to prove that a lot of what they were saying was baloney. But, none of us really knew that much about it. It was just a new idea. And it was, now everybody takes anti-aging medicine for granted. They're, everybody. So, but it was a timely idea, and it fit exactly with the kind of work that I was doing.
Right. Well, looking at the anti-aging model takes us to the issue of Alzheimer's, because that has become such a condition of concern, and it's exploding in the population. The diagnosis and the concerns and just the consequences are pretty disturbing and devastating, actually. So I'm so glad we're having this conversation, because I think Alzheimer's is a fear that a lot of people have. And they're, especially as we age, that is always something that concerns people. The last thing you want is to lose your ability to have cognitive functioning and memories and remembrance of who you are. It's very scary. So let's talk about that.
Well,
and I guess my first – go ahead, Tim.
I was just going to say, there is great reason to worry and to have fear about it. 1 in 3 of us will die with Alzheimer's. And, it's a huge epidemic. When you look at the numbers, it's actually 1,000 times more people than will die of COVID when all the dust settles. But it's way slower and way more insidious, so it doesn't have that kind of urgency about it. If there's any one thing I want people to realize from our talk and from my book, is that we have now entered the era of treatable and reversible Alzheimer's disease. And not only that, but we've entered the era of treatable, reversible, preventable Alzheimer's. It is true that people in the middle to late stage of the disease, where there's destruction to brain tissue, we're not going to be able to reverse that. But in the early stages and as a preventive, it's absolutely treatable and reversible. And so people should relax and focus on these ideas rather than wringing their hands and feeling like they're going to be at the effect of their genes. There's really reason hope about this.
Yes, that's the whole point. There is good news, and people need to be aware and be proactive and take the steps and not feel that they are victims of their aging process or whatever. Because Alzheimer's wasn't always such a big and prevalent condition. This is relatively recent in our history. And I want us to really dissect this Alzheimer's trend, this disease, and look at what it is that you find from your research has driven this impact on the health of our brain. And maybe we need to begin by just defining what is Alzheimer's. Are we talking about all cognitive decline? Are we talking a specific type of cognitive impairment? What would be your definition? Let's Let's start there.
There's a lot of fuzzy thinking and fuzzy meanings to words. So let me be really clear. When I use the word Alzheimer's, I mean all dementias. I mean loss of memory. And the reason I do that is because it's a diagnosis that can't be made while a person's still alive. It's just impossible. You can make a really educated guess. Neurologists can make a really educated guess. If someone has, and it's so prevalent now that if a person has memory loss, significant memory loss, the odds are really high that it's Alzheimer's. I mean, when I mean significant, I mean I don't mean the senile, you know, forgetting a word or a name or going into a room and not being sure for a second or two while you're there. Not that. I'm talking about the deeper kind of symptomatology. But so dementia, just to also be clear, is a symptom. Dementia is not a disease, it's a symptom. It's loss of memory. So Alzheimer's is the most common by far, about 95%, 97% of people with dementia have Alzheimer's disease. Actually, and we could get into this later, if you take the people who are thought of as having Alzheimer's disease, who are diagnosed as Alzheimer's, actually about half of them have something we call vascular dementia. And what it is the blood vessels in the brain are what are causing the disease rather than the nerves. In most cases, it is of Alzheimer's, of quotes, Alzheimer's disease. It's a combination of vascular dementia and Alzheimer's. About 90% of all cases have some degree of both. So, and in terms of the earlier part of your question, if you step back and take a broad view, as someone like me who spent 6 years poring over the medical research literature, as someone like me can do, what I see, and also with my functional medicine background, what I see is toxicity. I see the reason there wasn't that much before, at the time of Alzheimer's, it wasn't very common. There were dementias, but we can't really say how much there was because the disease hadn't been discovered yet. But the best information we have would say that there wasn't anywhere near the number of cases that we have now. Now, with a third of the world's population, it's obvious to me, and I'm sure this will prove out in the long run, that toxicity is the problem. And our cells are very sensitive to very small changes in the chemical environment that they have to live in. And when you add the amount of pollution in food and air and water that the average person is being subjected to, it adds up to causing metabolic dysfunction. If there's any one word that describes the underlying, you know, what's happening in Alzheimer's disease, it's metabolic dysfunction. The biochemical reactions that we need for life to go on are interfered with in a major way by even small amounts of pollutants. Later on, we'll probably talk about the various causes that we test for and the things that we treat to try to reverse the disease. You can trace most of them back further to toxicity. So it sort of weaves its way into the whole picture, and it's a huge problem. I'll just leave it there.
It is a huge problem, and it's, as you were saying, it's obvious as we understand what is impairing our health and all the manifestations of chronic illnesses. We have to look at what is required to create a healthy body and what's not occurring to do that. And we need to acknowledge that everything is dependent on the quality of the air we breathe, the water we drink, the quality of the food that we eat, the time we spend around our our devices, the radiation, these are all modern experiences, and they are taking their toll on us, and we have to wake up. You know, we have to look at the bigger picture. This isn't just something that showed up and is getting us. We've created it, and we need to understand all the pieces so we can either successfully prevent us going down that path or certainly take the steps to help reverse a condition that's appearing and presenting. And the earlier, the better.
Absolutely. You know, a few days ago I had this idea a way of thinking about what happens in Alzheimer's on a cellular level. You think of most of us have a pretty good idea of how our planet is being destroyed and through these same things. And you know, if you think of the human body as very similar to a planet that way, the deforestation, pollution of waterways, the toxicity of spraying food with pesticides and, overusing chemicals in so many different ways. All these things that we hear about in the news that are affecting our planetary weather and the future of our planet, it's happening on a microcosmic scale to the cells in our body. It's really a lot of the same processes. There's these complicated dynamics of complex systems that have to function together for the planet to really survive. And the same thing is true for a cell. There's an incredibly complicated, involving millions and millions of different chemicals that have to coordinate their activities in order for a cell to do its job. And, whether it's a global system or a cellular system, if you throw a wrench into that, which is what metabolic dysfunction is, it's going to start misfiring. And at first it's going to just start showing some symptoms, maybe weather pattern changes, maybe on a cellular level the cell doesn't do the job it's supposed to do. If it progresses, you have a serious problem.
So why don't we first start with what you have found to be the most egregious causes of impairment of the vascular system of the brain, and maybe explain that a little bit more for people. And then we can go into what you have researched and what you recommend for reversing Alzheimer's, which is really the purpose of your book.
Yeah, well, addressing the vascular component is a huge part of the whole idea of reversing the disease, so they're definitely not two different subjects. Maybe I should just very quickly give you an overview before I talk about the vascular part, which is very interesting to me because I've had problems in that area. It's one of the things that got me interested in writing this book. But let me just say, the way we reverse Alzheimer's is, first of all, to acknowledge that it is not a single disease. All the research for the last 50 years is looking for a drug that is aimed at, finding and correcting a single problem or a few small related problems, and all 400 of them have failed. So what Dr. Dale Bredesen figured out, and what alternative-minded functional medicine doctors have known for a long time, is diseases like Alzheimer's are multi-causal. They're not one disease. There are many different diseases. There are many different causes of a symptom picture that are happening simultaneously. And so when we with that in mind, what we do is identify those causes using biomarker testing, and then for each person's pattern, each person's picture is different. So each person would have a different combination of these metabolic dysfunctions, and each one of those is addressed, and a program that's in a very personalized program is put together to treat that person's combination of causes. And that's what Dr. Dale Bredesen accomplished in the breakthrough paper he wrote in 2014. So about half of those causes have to do with the, to answer your question about vascular dementia, half of those causes are directly affecting the vascularity in the brain. So the brain is about half nerves and about half blood vessels. And we have two different kinds of Alzheimer's. We have regular Alzheimer's, I'll call it, that is a breakdown in the functioning of the nerve cells in the brain. And then the other half, the vascular part, is when that breaks down, it's called vascular dementia. And vascular dementia is plaques and narrowing of the blood vessels mainly, and then small strokes that happen mostly in the subcortical white matter. But these two diseases are working side by side in about 90% of all Alzheimer's cases. So let me just tell you, in terms of the causes, the biomarkers that we test for the vascular, that address the vascular dementia part of it, are very straightforward things that everyone's familiar with. Serum cholesterol levels, blood sugar level, blood pressure. Homocysteine is a little less well known, but we look at homocysteine levels. We look at lack of exercise. Vitamin D plays a big role in how the vascular system works, so we look at that. And then those, if those markers are out of balance, we'll put the treatment into the overall treatment program and block it. And I can tell you I'm personally a really good example. I developed high blood pressure about 20 years ago, and I didn't treat it as aggressively as I should, and in 2012 I had a stroke. I had a minor stroke. When I was a medical student, it would have been called a TIA, a transient ischemic attack, but I went to the emergency room, got an MRI, and sure enough, there was a blocked blood vessel in my brain. Fortunately, it was a very small one, and the symptoms that I had of numbness down my leg went away by the end of the day, and I was spent the night in the hospital just for observation, and went home the next day, and I changed what I was doing in such a way as to get my cholesterol down and lower my blood pressure and lower my blood sugar. It was a wake-up call of ginormous proportions, and I call it my stroke of luck, because it was a stroke, but it was extremely lucky. I was extremely fortunate to be warned about what could happen, and then I started studying about it, and it turns out that a very high percentage, more than half of people my age, have had some of these strokes. Usually they're silent. They're called lacunar strokes. They're usually silent because the brain isn't that much affected by them, but they'll show up on an MRI. And you could see on my MRI there were about 15 or 20 little white spots that were previous symptom-free little strokes, just like the one that did cause symptoms the night before. So it's an extremely common problem, and it's poorly appreciated by doctors and lay people, the importance of it. So
Tim, can I ask you, what was it what happened to you that let you go, let your body become out of balance, that created the high blood pressure? What was going on for you in your life, or your lifestyle, or your, you know, stress levels, or your diet, that you weren't addressing or aware of that led to that? Because I think that's a really important question.
Yeah.
Due to the fact that many people have these conditions brewing and are not paying attention.
Yeah, I have way fewer excuses than the average person because I'm supposed to understand these things. But I think it was a combination of things. I am programmed for reasons that I don't understand to have a very high cholesterol, even if I eat no animal food or eat no cholesterol at all, my cholesterol is still quite high. I don't think that's really what was the main problem. I had high blood pressure, blood pressure is a very difficult problem. I spent a huge amount of time studying it. No one really knows what causes high blood pressure most of the time, and I had been trying to use natural methods to treat it, and that was part of why I got into trouble. I have to admit, I finally, after the stroke, I had to use blood pressure medications, which is really someone with my belief system, not what you want to be doing at all. And they had horrible side effects. I finally found some that don't have side effects, but I went through a couple of years of horrible side effects because my system was pretty clean, and you put these foreign chemicals in, and they cause problems. But I don't know why why I have high blood pressure. I had high blood pressure, high blood sugar, high cholesterol, I can tell you the blood sugar was me not eating properly. I was eating a high carb diet, and that's the kiss of death. And in fact, it might have been the underlying cause of the other two problems of the blood pressure and cholesterol. I really couldn't lower my carb intake, and now we know carb consumption is deadly. There's so much good evidence now in the research studies. A ketogenic diet, very low carb diet, is absolutely the best for everybody. And especially as we get old, when you're younger, your insulin regulating system can handle it, the deluge of carbs. But when you get older, it breaks down and it doesn't work. And so that's what I did. I was eating too many carbs also probably not exercising enough, but I was exercising every day. So that's the best answer I can give you. That was long enough back in time now that I can tell you I've fixed the problem with my combination of things I'd really rather not be doing in terms of medications. It was like the devil of the deep blue sea kind of, dilemma. If I didn't use the medications and I had another stroke, it might be a really bad one. So I didn't really feel like I had a choice. And I look at it as, in a future world where we understand how these things work, there will be way better solutions. The ones I've chosen haven't been intellectually satisfying to some extent, but they are working. And I've definitely retooled my diet completely because that is one thing that is under my control, and have been eating an extremely low-carb ketogenic type diet and practicing autophagy, which I think we can talk about later, but daily fasting.
Okay, thanks for sharing that. I think there's, there are moments when we have to do what we have to do. And
yeah.
We have to let our belief systems go. And if taking high blood pressure is going to support you so you reduce your risk, then that's what you have to do. That's what anyone has to do. We don't want to get too rigid in our belief systems, and I guess that was a lesson.
That's one of those.
You have to learn.
You hate to do it. But,
right?
And
I think
a lot of these, that experience had a lot to do with why I wrote this book. My mother's death from Alzheimer's, looking back, she absolutely had the same problem, and it killed her. It was an awful experience for us and her family and for me as a doctor and her son. But I look back and we don't have to go into the whole story, but I can I knew at the time we didn't know enough to do anything with about these things. But she had the same thing. She had high cholesterol. She had high. Her blood sugar was high, and she had high cholesterol. So I saw the handwriting on the wall, and I think that I've reversed it, and I'm happy about that. And I think helping people understand how this all works through there's several chapters in the book that address this. There's a chapter on blood sugar. There's a chapter on cholesterol. There's a chapter on blood pressure. There's a chapter that describes vascular dementia. And it's all integrated into the bigger picture of Alzheimer's. So
it was my stroke of luck. It was a wake-up call. And obviously the story of vascular dysfunction in the brain and dementia and Alzheimer's is a big story in your life because of what you just shared with your mother and then with your brush with that. So it's compelled you to investigate and to share with us what you're learning to help all of us. And it's like the story of the wounded healer and how the most profound healers have gone through their healing crises.
Yes.
So, Tim, what are the biggest steps we need to take to support our brain, to support our vascular health? What would you say are the most critical things that I would say have a direct impact on the brain, but we're probably also talking about the greatest impact on our overall health and well-being?
Absolutely. The newest breakthroughs in cell biology and molecular biology have to do with a newly emerging field called epigenetics. And a lot of what my book is about is how to affect the epigenetic system. So epigenetics is what controls which of our genes express themselves, which of our genes are used to do things, and which how they get turned on and off, and since the discovery of DNA and chromosomes and genes back in the 1950s, no one's ever been able to answer that question until just the past few years. We knew all about the genes, and we learned a lot about what they are programmed to do, but no one was ever able to explain what turns them on, what tells them to do their job. These genes each have a job, and what tells them to do their job? So just in the past few years, it's been learned how that works. And to make a really complicated story simple, there are things called transcription factors that are proteins that sit right next to the gene. They actually surround the genes, and they are what tells the gene what to do and whether to express itself or not, whether to turn on or turn off. And so these transcription factors are the next logical question is, well, what controls the transcription factors? And it turns out that it's very interesting. And on deep philosophical and psychological levels, it's very interesting. What determines the transcription factors is what you, there are things that you as a person do, what you eat, whether you exercise, what you drink, what kind of medications you take, what supplements you take, and even down to what thoughts you have. A thought can affect how a gene, so all of these different, what we call them, lifestyle factors, all the things I just mentioned. So all these lifestyle factors are talking to and deciding, which transcription factors to make. If you eat a sweet roll for breakfast, you're going to get a certain set of transcription factors immediately from that piece of food that's going to start telling your genes to malfunction. If you have blueberries for breakfast, you're going to have transcription factors that enhance the protection from Alzheimer's, that turn on the genes that protect you from Alzheimer's. So as I go through these lists of answers to Cheryl's question, the bottom line is what produces the kinds of transcription factors that protect your brain, that turn on the anti-Alzheimer's, also anti-heart disease, anti-cardiovascular disease, anti-cancer, that turn on these genes, and which food choices turn on the pro-cancer, pro-Alzheimer, pro-vascular disease genes. These are choices that we make with literally every bite of food, and if we make enough of the wrong choices, the disease is going to happen. If you make enough of the right choices, it's not going to happen. The beauty of epigenetics and this whole process that I just described is the following. We used to think, everybody used to think, that we were at the mercy of our genes. How many people have you heard say that? You know, it's in my genes. What can I do? It's in my genes. Well, that's not true. We know it's now not true. We know that all of your genes are accessible through your behavior choices. And it's whether you get exercise or not. It's whether you eat the right kinds of foods or not. And literally, whether you think the right kinds of thoughts or not, things like meditation, yoga, positive reinforcement of various kinds, all affect the combinations of genes that are turned on and which are turned off. So it's a big deal, and it's so empowering. It puts us in control of our genetic destiny and of our actual real life destiny. And the surface is just being scratched in this field, but everything I just said is known to be true. But you're gonna see in the future where we can get a lot more specific about the choices we make and the genetic effects that they have. That those choices have in terms of transcription factors. So if you want to turn on the transcription factors that prevent Alzheimer's, you will eat things like eggs, walnuts, blueberries, all vegetables, coconut oil, avocados, green tea, believe it or not, coffee. All berries are good for you. Eggs are packed with all kinds of good things. There are long lists. I'm not going to go any further, but there are long lists in the book of dietary choices, and actually there's a several chapters that explain the underlying philosophy to making these choices, why not just going off lists of foods that are okay, but understanding the idea of what you're really trying to accomplish. We all know what foods turn on the genes that are bad for us. Stuff like sugar, wheat, fast food, junk food, gluten, foods cooked in aluminum pans, fish, believe it or not, because they have mercury in them. These are all foods that are damaging to the body, set off these metabolic dysfunctions that end up being damaging cellular function and end up causing Alzheimer's and many other diseases. In terms of supplements, let me talk about fats for a minute. Fats is a complicated subject. I deal with it in depth in the book. To really oversimplify, coconut oil and medium-chain triglycerides are really good for you. Omega-3 oils, which are hard to get, but you can get from flaxseed oil, and walnuts are important. Discouraging omega-6 oils, which are damaging and turn on the pro-Alzheimer's disease genes. They're listed in the book. And then there are numerous supplements. But should I go ahead and do you want to talk about those now, or I can just list them? Or there's about eight supplements that have deep scientific validation in terms of reversing Alzheimer's and preventing Alzheimer's. I'll just read and tell you what they are.
Well, let's Well, before we get there, I just think it's so important for people to really understand how critically important it is to make healthy choices when it comes to our diet. Because, you know, you gave, you know, the list of the most common healthy foods that support our, you know, the information to our genes. And I do nutrigenomics, Tim, so I really have been fascinated by food and information that they provide to our genes to optimize expression.
Yeah.
And, you know, we... I think the challenge, the biggest challenge, most people probably have an idea of the things that are good, and that donut and, you know, that bagel may not be in your best interest. But the challenge is these foods, by their very nature, are addictive. And unless we're really compelled, like you were, because you were suddenly facing a chronic condition that could impair you, it's always a challenge, isn't it, for people to change behaviors.
Yes.
And especially when we're dealing with addictions, and they are addictive.
Yes, I would just say there's a momentum to the system I described of epigenetics, where the transcription factors are talking to the DNA, and the body kind of gets used to dealing with the bad thing, whatever it is, the poor food choices of various kinds, and so it doesn't want to change. And then it actually starts, when you first start to change, it doesn't feel so good because you're taking away that thing that it sort of was running okay on it, but not so well. And it had its workarounds, the molecular level workarounds. So when you change, it's hard. And then, but the interesting thing is, once you do change, and I recommend slow change. I changed slowly, really, even though I had that scare, I definitely still changed slowly, and I'm still changing. The thing I'm trying to say is, once the body gets running on the right fuel and you're putting in the right kinds of foods, it loves it, and it hums, and it feels really good, and that's addicting. But getting over that hump, it's like the little train that could, you know. You have to get over the discomfort of the food that's not so good for you, or of taking that away. There are also immune reasons. The immune system makes antibodies to these foods that that are bad for you, and then when you take the food out of the system and don't expose yourself to it anymore, the antibodies start causing inflammatory reactions in the brain and elsewhere, and that's uncomfortable. So on an immune level also, it's changing away from these really awful foods it's very uncomfortable.
So is it like withdrawal?
Yes, it is what it is. It's withdrawal. But like with most withdrawals, right, once you get through it, then the cravings go away, because the antibody production gets turned off, which is another genetic phenomenon.
So just to emphasize this point, that eating foods that raise our blood sugar levels and create insulin resistance and leads to being overweight and diabetes and inflammation in the body, let's just say, these are the critical issues that are driving what could become Alzheimer's manifestation or dementia. So this is just such an important point I want to emphasize for everyone listening. It's like, if we want to be healthy, we have to give up the high-carb diet, the sweets, the breads, the croissants, and all the things that we've loved. And
yes,
we love.
Absolutely.
I used to love them too, right?
And
and because they're pervasive, they're cheap. I mean, if you go into, you know, supermarkets, that's what we have been conditioned to eat, and we have been given those choices, and they're advertised every day everywhere. And it has been the downfall of our society, to be totally honest. So it's a really important point. And
absolutely,
you cannot
right.
be healthy. You cannot support a healthy brain. You cannot regenerate and age in a healthy way if you continue to make those choices. Bottom line. Right?
Absolutely.
And you know, the older you get, the more critical it is to pay attention to what we're talking about, because it's like you can be on a downhill slide if you are not responsible for the choices you're making. Because you can either get, you wrote a book about rejuvenation, and I'm fascinated by the ability to get healthier as we get young, as we get older, to get feel healthier and more energized and younger in a sense as we get older. That fascinates me because I'm at that stage of my life. That's what I want.
Yeah.
But it takes a disciplined approach, and we have to understand that you don't have a lot of room to indulge.
Exactly. Well said.
So I want to talk about the key nutrients, but I particularly want you to start with vitamin D, because you said earlier in our conversation that vitamin D has a really important part to play in vascular health, and I want to know why.
Well, you could start with the fact that vitamin D controls over 2,000 different genes. In particular, vitamin D is especially important in terms of controlling the genes that control blood sugar. So vitamin D plays a key role in many, just a broad array of different bodily functions. I don't have the list here in front of me, but you can't really find a major system that doesn't depend on optimum vitamin D.
So I think that's such an important point, because vitamin D, well, obviously it's some sunshine. We need to understand, you can't just rely on the vitamin. You do need sunshine for a lot of reasons, but to be able to measure your vitamin D, to understand the role of vitamin D supplementation if you can't get enough sunshine, is just absolutely critical. And it's one test that you definitely want to get. You need one marker in your
Everybody
blood test.
Everybody should know their vitamin D level. It's more important than cholesterol.
And what's your ideal number on your vitamin D test? What do you recommend?
80 to 100 nanograms per deciliter.
Wow, really up high, a high end.
Well, it isn't high in my world. I know that people would say that's high, but it really isn't. It's the range at which you have optimum health. So
well, that's
the research literature supports that number. I could say 70 to 100, but I really think 80 is healthier.
Wow. Can I say that I find, if we're just talking about vitamin D and vitamin D supplementation, I don't know what your experience is, Tim, but I have found that using a vitamin D supplementation that's a micellized vitamin D, which is making fat molecules really, really tiny, so it's absorbable in water, is a way to increase vitamin D much more efficiently than the fat-soluble vitamin D, which is the usual vitamin D supplement. Particularly if you're overweight, it seems to be the regular vitamin D doesn't seem to be able – it's like it gets absorbed but not utilized properly. I don't know if you found that, but I just while we're mentioning it, people want to get some good vitamin D, get some micellized D.
Yeah, I don't know. I haven't looked at that subject, so I don't know. But I can tell you in general, micellized forms of anything, because the cell membrane is made out of fat, when you micellize, you're making it fat soluble, and then so that particle that has the D in it can dissolve into the cell membrane and be absorbed really efficiently. So I would assume micellized D would be better absorbed than regular D. In my research for the book, I didn't really come across any studies that suggested there were problems with D absorption, though. So I really don't know. Vitamin D. Low vitamin D doubles the risk of Alzheimer's.
Wow. So, and low, you would say, is anything under 70?
Yeah, I think the studies that were done probably used 50 as a cutoff, but I don't have the study right here in front of me. I don't remember exactly what it said, but they compared.
I would just say that just knowing that piece of information is profound, because people can check their vitamin D test results, and
yes,
if they see that the number is under 50, they have work to do to get it up, because then they're at their risk. But and the thing is that vitamin D impacts so many other key functions, so protective on so many levels. So that's just one very profound thing that can easily and inexpensively be resolved. And I always encourage people to try to get some sunshine too.
Absolutely. There'll be the sunshine is important, and I think sunshine does a lot more things for us than just vitamin D production. But you can't rely on the sun for optimum levels of vitamin D for just about everybody, even if you are sunbathing almost all the time. It's hard to get up into these 80 to 100 range levels. So I would take a supplement. If you really want to make sure your D is in the right range, get tested. Vitamin D changes very slowly. So if you wait a few months and get tested again and then see what the average is, and then if it's still low, you want to increase the dose some more. It can take up to a year to find the right dose, just because vitamin D has a half-life of about 40 days, so you can see that the changes in the blood levels are going to be slow. But just keep working at it. I mean, if you tested in a few weeks and didn't see any change, it wouldn't be meaningful, because you would not have waited long enough for that dose to take effect. But I recommend changing dose if necessary once every few months, and just shoot for that 80 to 100. Anybody, you know, doctors will look at 100 and they'll go, oh, you're going to get vitamin D toxicity. Well, I've spent weeks studying the vitamin D literature, and I challenge anybody to find a meaningful study where anyone was hurt by a vitamin D of under 120. So there's really, you don't have to worry about getting too much, but you really do have to worry about getting too little.
Good advice. That's great, because there's so much confusion around that. So I'm so glad you clarified it. We have only a few more minutes left, Tim. It's been a great conversation. It's gone really fast.
Yes, it has.
So what else do you think is critically important in the few minutes that we have that people need to know about or take? Or is there another really critical supplement that is
exercise
vital for?
Haven't talked about exercise, and there actually really isn't a lot to say about it. Just do it. I hate to be a spokesperson for a sneaker company, but just do it. You need to exercise every day. The single most important way of generating these transcription factors I was talking about is to get exercise every day, and you don't have to break any records. You don't have to injure yourself. Walking for people over 40 or so is plenty good enough. For people under 40, probably running or jogging. I mean, there's great evidence showing that an hour a day is necessary to create the kind of changes that you want. And I can tell you, with all of the things I was saying about transcription factors, and I didn't mention BDNF or neurogenesis, but these are other ideas that are related to the transcription factor idea. BDNF is brain-derived neurotrophic factor, and BDNF tells nerve cells to heal and grow and multiply, which we never thought they did until a few decades ago. So the single best way to stimulate neurogenesis is exercise. Way better than any food or any diet. The foods do it too, but nothing is as powerful at stimulating neurogenesis as exercise. And Kirk Erickson, a professor at the University of Pittsburgh, did a research study with 60-something-year-olds, 50 and 60-year-olds, and he showed that the size of their brains increased. He had a control group that didn't exercise and a control group that did, and he documented a 2% increase per year in brain size in the group that exercised. And there's a bunch of others. That's a nice one because it's real clean, but there are many other studies that show the same thing. You can actually increase the size and health of your brain just by getting that hour a day of exercise. And I didn't single out walking and jogging by accident. It's the single most important thing. It should be the fundamental exercise you do. It's great to do other things. They help too, but the lower body core muscles have to be moved, and the blood moving systems that those muscles are involved with have to be moved. So when I say exercise, I mean walking or jogging.
How about bicycling?
As a part of, you know, as a basis of it, not the only thing, but as the base thing that you do a little of every day at least.
Does that include bicycling?
Bicycling is not walking, unfortunately.
Okay.
Exercise.
All right.
Okay,
I gotta get.
Same. It has to be
okay. All right. Good. I'll get back to walking. But I even going to the gym, which I've started doing. But yeah, some form of exercise, like you were saying, if it's just walking a couple of times around the block, anybody can do that. Just do what you can do. Start there.
Exactly. It's the single most powerful way of enhancing the health of your brain.
Wow. So simple, so cheap.
Yeah.
So Tim, we've come to the end of this fascinating conversation. You know, Reversing Alzheimer's, which is Dr. Tim Smith's latest book, is really a critical piece of knowledge for us to access. So I encourage everyone to pick up a copy. We need to be proactive in our life. We have all of the resources available to reverse the condition, especially early on when you first notice that your memory is just not at your peak, and then, of course, be proactive earlier in your life. So if people want to learn more about Dr. Tim Smith, his website is timsmithmd.com. His new book is Reversing Alzheimer's. I'm so grateful for the tremendous amount of research you have done, Tim, to put this together in one place. And I just wish you the greatest success, because it's critically important that we know that we actually have the resources, the strategies to reverse Alzheimer's. An important mission in your life. And thank you so much for sharing with us today.
Oh, thank you. It's really been a pleasure chatting with you and talking about these things. So thank you.
You're so welcome. And thank you all for listening. This is Dr. Cheryl Selman. You're listening to What Women Must Know. We'll talk again soon. And until then, always honor the wisdom of the feminine self. Bye for now.